Thank you, Professor Sarrett. And why don't we start with one question? Let me read it, a couple of paragraphs. The advent of DNA testing would seem, at second glance, to have an ambiguous potential vis-a-vis the death penalty. While it has been directly and indirectly responsible for getting a number of innocent people off death row, and in the process expanding skepticism about the legitimacy of the death penalty, at the same time, it also offers the prospect of certitude, in some cases at least, about who is guilty. Is it possible that in the future we will see fewer executions, but less doubt about those we do execute? And along these lines, it strikes me that there's something mysterious about changes in attitude toward the death penalty, that it might be almost as hard to explain them as it is to explain the big drop in crime itself over the past 15 years. In your view, what causes death penalty sentiment to wax and wane over the decades? Thanks for that good question.
That's a terrific question. Let me begin with the second part of it. I think that what's caused death penalty attitudes to change in the United States, really rather significantly in the recent period, has been the shift that I described from the abstract question of whether the death penalty is just to the more concrete question about whether the death penalty can be administered in a way which is compatible with due process of law and equal protection under the law. You see, I think what's happening is that when people move from the abstract question to the more concrete question, they begin to have doubts about whether or not the death penalty, while perhaps fine as a philosophical commitment, is compatible with the values to which they are also deeply committed, namely fairness, equality, and the simple but appealing proposition that it's wrong to execute the innocent. Now, that takes me back to the first part of your question. I think, as your question suggests, DNA is a kind of double-edged sword in the arsenal of the new abolitionism. Indeed, it may very well be that the new abolitionism is not abolitionism at all. It may be that the new abolitionism is a kind of reformism, and that we will indeed end up with fewer executions, but, as your question says, less doubt about those we execute. From a perspective of abolitionism, that, I think, is a risk that must be taken, because there really is no other effective argument against the death penalty, I think, in the United States today than the rhetoric of the new abolitionism.
Great. Another question. How does the exclusion of particular populations, young people, people who commit child rape, and of course people with mental retardation, from the death penalty fit into your theory? Certainly it coheres with the abolitionist notion, but it occurs largely through the Eighth Amendment, not equal protection or due process, except in concerns voiced in these opinions about getting it wrong in certain cases.
Do I get to guess who asked this question, Betsy?
You do.
Okay, let me see. I'll bet you the person who asked this question is an aspiring law professor who will indeed have a distinguished career. And I hope she'll contribute now a little more to the annual fund. I think that the exclusion of particular populations from the death penalty does, in fact, fit into this theory. What I see the Supreme Court as doing in Roper versus Simmons and Atkins versus Virginia is limiting the reach of capital punishment, and in so doing, beginning to chip away at the belief that capital punishment is always the appropriate response to even the most heinous crimes. Indeed, one might say that there's a parallel between the Supreme Court's approach to capital punishment and the Supreme Court's approach to abortion. Rather than frontally attacking Roe versus Wade, what the Supreme Court has done, along with the Congress of the United States, has been to limit the reach of abortion rights. Similarly, with respect to the death penalty, the decisions about mental retardation and juvenile killers limit the reach of capital punishment. So I see these things as further evidence that we are on the road to abolition.
Great. And next we have a response to one of your questions, Professor Sarrett, and that is, yes, we are on the road to abolition, thank God. Yet prosecutors are pushing for the death penalty for the suspected 9/11 terrorists who are now going to stand trial in New York City, and the sniper was just put to death last week. Are these cases unique?
I think, again, that's a great question. If we were to examine the more than 3,000 people who are on America's death row, most of them do not resemble the sniper who wreaked havoc in Washington, D.C., or the 9/11 terrorists. The most dangerous place to be would be at a 7-Eleven at 3 o'clock in the morning if you're a store clerk. That's where the kinds of crimes that get people the death penalty are more likely to occur. And I want to go back to the question that was asked before about DNA and its possible impact. It may very well be that along the road to abolition, the death penalty will be increasingly narrowed so that when it is only used for serial killers, mass murderers, or terrorists. And that in itself, I would also say, would be a step on the road to abolition.
And another question, and we've had a couple along this particular line. Professor Sarrett, do you see any parallel between the widespread national, quote, soul-searching prompted by Israel's execution of Eichmann, her only death penalty recipient, and the current swell of reconsideration about capital punishment here in America? Is there anything to be learned from Israel or any other country's reversals when it comes to capital punishment?
I think the soul-searching here, if that's what we want to call it, is of a different kind than the soul-searching after the execution of Eichmann. And we have to recall that Israel itself has a very, very limited death penalty provision. But the soul-searching here, I think, is of much more incremental and less dramatic kind. The soul-searching here is occurring in jury boxes in capital cases across the United States when jurors confront the question of whether they should put to death not an Eichmann or a McVeigh or a Bin Laden, but some young person with a history of mental problems who committed a horrible crime. And as to what we can learn from other countries, I think if we look at what happened in Europe on the road to abolition, there is a clear prediction or a clear foretelling of our own path. In Europe, most countries in Europe abolished capital punishment in practice long before they took the laws off the books. They just stopped using capital punishment. And then some time period later, after the public had gotten used to the idea that they could, quote, live without capital punishment, parliaments in various European countries did the last act of taking capital punishment off the books. And that, as I said, is what I think will be the path that America takes.
All right, the questions are coming fast and furious. The prospect of the prospect of receiving the death penalty is a powerful negotiating tool in the arsenal of the prosecutor when looking for the truth about the commission of serious crimes. Why not keep the death penalty and work to improve the process so innocent people do not land on death row? Those who feel we need the death penalty will see through the new arguments being proposed to eliminate the death penalty.
Well, it may very well be that people who, quote, see the need for the death penalty will not be persuaded by new abolitionist arguments. But I think there's a lot of evidence that more and more people are being persuaded by new abolitionist arguments. Not only do we see that registered in public opinion surveys, we see it, as I said, registered in a dramatic decline in the number of people being sentenced to death and in the number of people being executed. And I can't say that the most hardcore supporters of capital punishment will finally be convinced by new abolitionist arguments. I just can't say that. But I think that the death penalty is likely to be abolished in the United States, as it was in Europe, in the face of some support for capital punishment, which becomes increasingly less intense. I mean, if you look at Europe, what you saw was when the parliaments of European countries abolished capital punishments, majorities of their public still supported capital punishment. Indeed, I think it is true today that in many European countries, the public still supports capital punishment. As to why we shouldn't keep the death penalty and work to improve it, I think the prospect of life imprisonment without parole is itself a pretty good negotiating tactic. And just to give you a preview of my next appearance on Amherst Radio, a new project that I'm going to launch is going to look at life without parole as America's new death penalty. So I hope you'll stay tuned for that.
All right. We've had a few really good questions.
I just made a hand gesture at the microphone here.
He did. Isn't the abolitionist argument based on cost merely a reflection of the tactics of the opponents of the death penalty, which have driven the costs and the delays, and the fact that there are a significant number of judges who, despite the law, remain philosophically opposed to capital punishment and act accordingly?
That's a terrific point, but here's the paradox. The more we spend on capital punishment, the more we can believe that those that we execute really deserve it. So that costs are not just driven by lawyers filing frivolous claims or judges who are philosophically opposed to capital punishment. Costs are driven because the United States Supreme Court has said death is different. Before we can execute someone, we must have the greatest confidence that the person we are putting to death deserves to die. Well, there's lots of evidence that in spite of the cost, in spite of the resources that are invested in trying to make sure that the people that we sentence to death deserve to die, we don't do a very good job of it. 130 people over the course of the period since 1976, that's a lot of mistakes to make in a system which is designed to ensure that we don't execute the innocent, we don't put to death people who don't deserve it.
All right, here we have a question. Number two, an answer to your question. The potential problem with the new abolitionism. If the death penalty should be found unconstitutional because it cannot be implemented perfectly fairly and without any arbitrariness, then wouldn't we need to find unconstitutional any law that allows any discretion in sentencing?
I love this question. The answer to that is easy. What I tell my students is, if ever asked a question about the death penalty that seems complicated or difficult to answer, simply say death is different. And that's actually what the United States Supreme Court has said, that the jurisprudence surrounding death is unique because death is unique. So even if we were to say that the death penalty should be ruled unconstitutional because it is administered in an arbitrary and discriminatory way, that would not in and of itself mean that we would have to do anything about discretionary sentencing in any other part of our criminal justice system.
Thank you. Professor Sarrett, this is from a questioner. Thank you for your time, work, and great thoughts in putting together this series.
Then just stop right there. Go to the next question.
I've heard discrimination is a part of the entire justice system, ranging from arrests to convictions to sentencing. If that is true, and if discrimination is a reason to reconsider the death penalty, should there be a serious reassessment of the rest of the system? Is this happening?
Well, again, this makes reference to the adequacy of the death is different argument. If you are persuaded that death is different, or different enough, then you can say that whatever we say about capital punishment in the way of its arbitrariness or its discrimination or its unfairness or its inability to distinguish who deserves this sentence from those who do not deserve it does not apply anywhere else in the legal system. But I think there is a serious reassessment, a serious looking at the rest of the system. Let's just remind ourselves of the context in which capital punishment occurs in the United States. We have more than 2 million people in prisons and jails. We imprison more people per capita for more crimes and for longer sentences than any other constitutional democracy on the globe. And many people on the left of the political spectrum and on the right of the political spectrum are beginning to try to think now about whether or not that way of responding to crime makes a lot of sense. And let me just draw your attention to two cases that were recently argued before the United States Supreme Court on the question of whether or not life without parole is constitutional when given as a sentence to juvenile offenders who did not commit homicide. So I think there are signs, I think they're less clear in these other areas of sentencing than they are in the death penalty, that America is rethinking its punitiveness.
Excellent. Thank you. And another question that just came in takes us to Europe. And this question is, why, on what grounds, did European countries move strikingly toward abolition? And why don't those arguments have more traction here?
Right. Well, the European experience with abolition, some of that European experience occurred in the shadow of World War II. Some of that European experience was a response to the trauma of the Holocaust. Some of it was a response to the belief that a state so strong to kill so many of its people was a danger to all of its people. And as I indicated earlier, much of the European experience, de facto abolition before de jure abolition, I think does lay out a path that America may take. But remember, America is exceptional in many ways. In one way, with respect to capital punishment, abolition here could be much more complicated. In Europe, when England decides to abolish the death penalty, all that needs to happen is Parliament needs to do it. In the United States, as you know, we have 51 separate jurisdictions, the 50 states and the federal government. So merely because the death penalty is abolished in New Jersey or New Mexico tells us nothing about when or whether it will be abolished in Oklahoma or Connecticut. So short of a United States Supreme Court decision striking down the death penalty as unconstitutional, a prospect that, as he indicated earlier, I think will eventually happen, but short of that, abolition, the battle for abolition, is a state-by-state affair, much more complicated than anything Europe had to deal with.
Professor Sarrett, again, on public sentiment, this question, doesn't the wide support of the recent execution in Virginia of the mass killer show that the public is hardly up in arms against capital punishment?
I think that's right. I think the public is hardly up in arms against capital punishment. But I think the public is hardly up in arms in favor of capital punishment. Think about the 2008 presidential election. Capital punishment was barely on anybody's radar screen. Contrast that to 1988. So I think what I see in the United States is that death penalty attitudes, or shall I say support for the death penalty, is still quite broad, but it is mostly quite shallow. That's not to say that in particular cases, particular segments of the population will feel quite intensely that certain criminals having committed certain crimes deserve the death penalty. That's why I asked my question about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. The fact that particular executions can rouse intense feelings in favor of capital punishment tells us, I think, very little about the overall situation of capital punishment in the United States.
Thank you. And from another one of your past students, do you have any reflections on the political and judicial dynamic that has played out over the past 40 years? More specifically, have judicial pronouncements on constitutionality from the standpoint of morality, cruel and unusual, accelerated or delayed the abolitionist cause based on workability, due process, equal protection concerns? Comparisons to impact of judicial intervention in social debate on abortion and more recently gay marriage would be welcome. Professor Sarrett.
That's a fabulous question. I think that, in fact, what you call judicial pronouncements on capital punishment from the standpoint of morality, cruel and unusual, really aren't much of a barrier anymore. Because, as I said, even in the Supreme Court today, those arguments just have much less traction. You may remember that in 2002, a federal district judge sitting in New York, I believe, declared the federal death penalty unconstitutional as a violation of not the Eighth Amendment, but the Due Process Clause. Now, his opinion was very quickly, his decision was very quickly reversed. But if you listen to, for example, the statements of former Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, or read Justice Stevens's opinion in the case of Bays versus Reese, you see that what animates them in their growing doubts about capital punishment aren't issues of morality, but are issues of process. And what I indicated earlier about the parallel between the path that opponents of abortion are taking, namely not frontally attacking Roe versus Wade, but rather trying to limit the reach of abortion, is, I think, a model that abolitionists are and will follow.
Thank you. Another question. Trial and punishment is an important alternative to extrajudicial recourse by and for the victims and their families. Punishment is also the way a society makes clear what conduct is absolutely wrong. Could you discuss the death penalty in these terms?
Sure. That we punish tells us nothing about how we ought to punish. When a society punishes, it does more than rebuke the wrongdoer. It expresses its own values and commitments. So the question that death penalty opponents would ask is, does the death penalty make us a safer society, a saner society, a less violent society, a society that gets closer to the realization of its most important values? And that's what the argument is about. The argument isn't about whether or not if we get rid of the death penalty, we get rid of punishment. That's why I indicated that one of the most important factors in the movement on the road to abolition has been the institution of life imprisonment without parole. Well, life without parole is a death penalty. It's a slower death penalty, but it is a death penalty. Its advantage, to the extent that it has an advantage, is that if a mistake is made and we find out 5 years later or 10 years later that a mistake has been made, we can let someone out of prison. Think about the controversy surrounding the execution of a man named Whittingham in Texas, which has recently surfaced. There's now good reason to believe that Keith Whittingham was wrongfully executed, that he was not guilty of the crime. What does it say about a society that it would retain a form of punishment in which mistakes, if they are made, are irreversible? So I'd like to ask that question as much as, what is it that punishment says about or says to the offenders?
Great, thank you. And in that question, you just addressed the next question I was going to ask, so I'll move on. This alum writes in, so much for the process we're in. Which of the arguments do you support? Do you think the direction we're going is correct or wrong, and why?
I think you have to pay extra for me to tell you what I think. And as some of you may know or not, one of the things that I believe most important in teaching at a place like Amherst is that one keeps one's views as much as possible to the side. But okay, this is not my classroom. I think that we are on the road to abolition and that abolition will come. And I believe that when it does come, the United States will be better for it. I believe that the path to abolition that we're on, looking carefully at what the death penalty does to us, not what the just what the death penalty does for us, is the right way to go. And I think at the end of that consideration of what the death penalty does to us, not just what it does for us, the United States will end up without capital punishment.
All right. And continuing from your students, thanks for giving us hope, Austin. Do you think that Russia's moratorium on the death penalty will give the U.S. some impetus to end the death penalty?
Well, I don't think the United States, I don't think the people of the United States are eager to see themselves as imitating Russia. So the Russian experience, I think, is important in some broad sense, but I don't think you're going to hear a lot of abolitionists on the O'Reilly Factor or the Rachel Maddow show trumpeting what's happened in Russia. It may very well be that there are many people who spend a lot of time in the mountains of Colorado who are interested in what happens in Russia. But those of us who have our feet closer to the ground, we have other things to think about.
And I think we'll have time for just one more question so that we have a couple minutes to wrap up. And so here we go. Doesn't a politician's support for the death penalty serve as a proxy for being tough on crime in a way that cabins a politician's options, that is, absent support of the death penalty, a politician can be painted as not tough on crime? Doesn't this sort of proxy simplify our politics in a way that makes more sophisticated arguments about capital punishment more problematic from a practical standpoint?
Yeah, I think that question has echoes of another time. I think, in fact, we're in a period in which politicians are increasingly getting wiggle room. Now, again, New Jersey, New Mexico, they're not Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Georgia. So I think that today politicians just have a little more space. They may not have the space right now to come out directly and say that the death penalty is wrong, but they certainly have space to raise questions about its fairness, about its cost, about the ways in which it is administered. And by the way, those are questions that are raised not just by people on the left, but by people like Arnold Schwarzenegger in California, the former director of the FBI, Mr. Sessions, and the conservative columnist George Will. So I think that in this period of reconsideration of capital punishment, it just isn't right to say that the only way to signal that one is tough on crime is to wave the bloody flag of capital punishment. Thank you all for your questions and for your attention, and I look forward to seeing you all back home soon.
And I join Professor Sarrett in thanking you. We weren't able to get to all of your questions. There were many, many good questions. We appreciate them. Hope you'll join us for our January call, and thanks again. Have a good afternoon.